History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. In 1950, 5 years after the conclusion of World War II, Winston Churchill remarked that he was still amazed how the United States was able to rapidly grow from a small peacetime nation before the war into the globe's preeminent military power. He said, "It remains a mystery to me, as yet unexplained, how the very small staffs, which the United States kept during the years of peace, were able not only to build up the armies and Air Force units, but also to find the leaders and vast staffs capable of handling enormous masses and moving them faster and farther than masses have ever been moved in war before." Now, he wasn't talking about the United States in general, but he was speaking about two men in particular, Chief of Staff George Marshall and Secretary of War Henry Stimson. From 1940 until the end of the war, Marshall and Stimson worked in adjoining offices, the door was always open between the two, and they headed the army machine that ground down the Axis. Theirs was probably the most important collaboration of the 20th century. In fact, Dwight Eisenhower once said George Marshall possessed more of the qualities of greatness than any other American he ever met in his life, with Henry Stimson a close second. And it was the greatness of their partnership that helped save the world. Now, the two had very different paths to power. Stimson was educated at Yale and Harvard. He was a skull and bones in the former. And he joined the Wall Street firm of Elihu Root, the future Secretary of War and State. He went on to serve as Secretary of War himself under William Howard Taft, then Governor General of the Philippines, and Secretary of State under Herbert Hoover. Although he was a Republican, he was an internationalist in his foreign policy and caught the eye of FDR. George Marshall was 13 years younger, enlisted in the Army, and during World War I, performed brilliant staff work for General Pershing. He ended up in Washington in the 1930s and impressed FDR himself with his candor and competence. There are different men who combined synergy to lead the American military effort in World War II. Their jobs blended business, diplomacy, and bureaucracy in addition to warfighting. They transformed an outdated, unprepared, poorly equipped U.S. Army into a modern fighting force of millions of men capable of fighting around the globe. Today, I'm speaking with Edward Aldrich, author of the book The Partnership, George Marshall, Henry Stimson, and the Extraordinary Collaboration That Won World War II. In addition to their leadership, these two were able to identify soldiers, from Patton and Eisenhower to Bradley and McNair, best suited for high command. They helped develop worldwide strategy and logistics for battles like D-Day and the Bulge. They collaborated with allies like Winston Churchill, although Stimson completely lacked a sense of humor and didn't like Churchill's sense of wit. Most importantly, these two planned for the post-war world. It was Marshall and also Stimson who put together the Marshall Plan and transformed Japan and Western Germany into modern democracies. These decisions would echo throughout the Cold War and long thereafter. So we're looking at an important chapter in this episode of World War II, but also how the post-war world order was formed and how it affects us today. I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Edward Aldrich. There's an interesting anecdote about George Marshall and Henry Stimson at the beginning of your book. When Franklin Roosevelt pairs Stimson with Marshall in the summer of 1940, anticipating World War II and America's involvement, the two work in adjoining offices where the door is deliberately left open at all times. What does that say about their working relationship in the 17 months leading up to America's entry into the war and then the years afterward?
It says quite a bit, and I think they did it for a few reasons. The first, they're both practical men, and both before the war started and during the war, they'd meet 3 to 5 times a day, either in one office or the other, or between the offices sometimes, constantly discussing things. So it's a very open relationship between the two of them. The second reason, and I try to stress this a lot, is I think they were sending a message to their respective staffs that there were absolutely no secrets between the civilian and military authorities in the Army. And this proved, in my opinion, to actually work out, because not only was their relationship exceptional, but there were no silos at all between the civilian and military staffs. They all got along incredibly well. And they also, they kind of viewed, regardless of whether you worked for Stimson or Marshall, they viewed both men as their bosses. They could both freely walk in and talk to one or the other without getting permission, as you see in some corporations, for example. You know, you usually have to speak to someone before speaking to their subordinate. It was very open. So I think it was a big symbolic gesture, and it really set the tone in the beginning that lasted throughout the pre-war period and the war period.
I think we'll come into this later on in the discussion about successful corporate hierarchies and when siloing happens, but more importantly, when it doesn't happen. I'm thinking of Robert Noyce and what became the Intel Corporation, how there was an open business plan that allowed people to talk to one another. But without getting too far ahead of ourselves, I'm curious, the approach that you're doing is sort of a dual biography of the two, because you note that symbiotic relationship. There's been a lot written about Marshall. If people know nothing else about him, they've heard about the Marshall Plan and the successful post-war order that was created, at least in Japan, a little bit less successfully in Eastern Europe, to be sure. But less has been written about Simpson and even less about the two working together. Why do you think that is?
Well, I mean, if you look back at the wars that America has fought, I think typically the people, the men on the front lines are the ones that are highlighted, whether publishers steer us towards them or we steer that towards us. And the secretaries of war during the Civil War, he's not very well known, Edward Stanton. Newton Baker, World War I Secretary of War, also absolutely unknown. And he played a huge role. And the chiefs of staff, similarly. We tend to put the man on the white horse on a pedestal. And we like to read about stories about the Eisenhowers, the Pattons, the MacArthurs, etc. And people that occupy desks in Washington, out of harm's way, they're just less compelling for people to write about or publishers to publish about.
Very true. And as you note, Stimson had the bad manners to die shortly after his role in World War II. Of course, he was a septuagenarian. He kept incredible hours, so he can be an inspiration to the wave of baby boomers out there who are retiring and not sure what to do with themselves with all this extra time on his hands. But let's start off with looking at the backgrounds of these two. Stimson was older during his active years, but he is also of a higher social background. He's an Ivy Leaguer. He's a Skull and Bones member. He's a successful lawyer. And a fact that automatically makes me like him more, a friend of Theodore Roosevelt. Can you tell me about his background and what leads him eventually to his position during the war?
Yeah, it is incredible that he's a friend of Teddy Roosevelt's, a good friend of Teddy Roosevelt's. And yet he worked for Franklin Roosevelt. It gives it an idea of the length and breadth of his career. He was wealthy, came from a wealthy New York family. His father was a doctor. Phillips of Andover, Yale, as you mentioned, Harvard Law, where he's number two in his class. He immediately joined a law firm run by Elihu Root, who was later Secretary of War and Secretary of State. And Stimson quickly became a top lawyer. And Teddy Roosevelt in 1906 asked him down to Washington and appointed him to be U.S. Attorney to the Southern District of New York. That was a big position back then, but you can divide all the U.S. attorneys of the Southern District of New York in a line, those who served before Stimson and those afterwards. He completely redefined the position, and he got the big public service bug after that and became kind of a Roosevelt man. And because of his success at that position, Taft named him Secretary of War in 1911. Again, 1911, we had one airplane in the Army and we were still fighting Native Americans. So that's his background. And from that point on, he became a wise man, so to speak, which was a term coined later. And going back and forth between corporate law and public service, he was a troubleshooter for Calvin Coolidge. He solved a civil war for Calvin Coolidge in Nicaragua. He was governor general of the Philippines. And then, of course, Hoover named him Secretary of State. And that ultimately led him to working for Franklin Roosevelt as Secretary of War. So it was very much a position that others followed after him, this concept of the wise men who people on the Northeast Corridor who are lawyers who go back and forth between the law and public service, regardless of what party they're affiliated with.
And I'm curious, what forged Stimson's views on foreign policy? He very much has a Theodore Roosevelt early 20th century progressive view of speak softly, carry a big stick. But this seems to stay with him throughout the post-World War I era of the United States when isolationism is very popular. And he even influences the next generation after him up to the point when, during the crises of the Kennedy administration, the Cuban Missile Crisis, Bay of Pigs, people are thinking, WWSD, what would Simpson do? Where is his ideology forged, and why do you think he carries it so strongly?
I think he's certainly influenced by both Root and Roosevelt, but Teddy Roosevelt. But I think his position as a corporate lawyer, he was really an advisor to the top corporations in the country, not only in our country, but also in Europe. So he was aware better than anyone of how connected, interconnected the world was from a trade standpoint. And so he became an interventionist, if you will, largely because of that. And whereas the rest of the country, such a vast majority, were isolationist, they didn't have that same appreciation that lawyers like Stimson on the East Coast had, or maybe on the West Coast as well, of just how you can't really let one side of the world explode without it affecting your interests. So I think that was a big part of it as well, a combination of his early mentors and his background in both corporate law and in serving the public, where he could go to conferences where he understood how the economies of the world were connected. So that's a huge part of it for him.
Looking at Marshall, he is not as high on the social ladder, but by no means on the bottom rung. He's an Army vet. He's a West Point graduate. And a point you note has a lot in common with George Washington. What's his background and what leads him to the White House?
So he definitely was not the Yale Harvard Law type or social status of a Stimson. He was from a small town in Pennsylvania, Uniontown, and he went to VMI, Virginia Military Institute. And a lot of people would be forgiven for thinking that that's a military school, but it's actually not. It's a liberal arts school that just happens to have believed back since the 19th century that the best way to teach liberal arts is through military discipline. So, for example, when Stimson graduated from there, he had no advantage over regular civilians in getting a commission. He joined the Army at the turn of the century, and from that point, just moved every 2 to 3 years from one remote Army fort to another. But at every single stop he made, he was beyond excellent. His record was stunning. He, very early on, he was considered the best student in the Army, and very soon after, the best teacher and the best staff officer. And of course, that didn't serve him well when it came to promotions, because that can curse you. If the top generals think you're first rate when it comes to a staff person, they're going to get you on your staff. And if you're on a staff, you're not commanding men. If you're not commanding men, you're not getting promotions. So right up to World War I, that hurt him. And during World War I, when he was put on Pershing staff, he did remarkable things. But MacArthur, who joined the Army a year after Marshall, was made general 16 years earlier because he had a different route. So definitely a different background, but he shared with Stimson the same quality of excellence. And I can't remember the second part of your question, Scott.
Well, more so what leads him to the White House. But since you mentioned Pershing, that was something that called to my mind. Now, Pershing, he conducted himself well during World War I, but there were also matters in which he led the war effort where many learned what not to do when World War II was conducted. And I'm curious what Marshall learned what to do and what not to do from Pershing. What I'm specifically thinking of has to do with logistics and supply during World War II. That one of Pershing's major mistakes was that he treated supply officers as second order. That if you did well on logistics and supply as an officer, you were promoted as a combat officer, or you were leading military strategy. Conversely, if you did poorly leading strategy, you were, quote unquote, demoted to supply. What that did was lead to less talented men leading supply and hampering logistics, but I'm sure it would also lead to a major morale problem. So, I mean, that's one example of Pershing doing something that the lesson was learned and the opposite was done in World War II, where supply was not seen as second order, but co-equal with strategy. What did Marshall learn from Pershing, you think, coming as his role as chief of staff in World War II?
He learned a great deal from Pershing. He was a huge fan of Pershing. And allow me to give an anecdote of one of the things he learned from him was he considered Pershing as a guy who had incredibly thick skin, who constantly welcomed criticism and sought it out. He didn't want simply yes men around him. And the anecdote goes back to World War I. Pershing had not really known of Marshall. And Pershing was going around prior to the first battle the Americans fought. We were very unprepared before World War I as well. So after Woodrow Wilson asked Congress to declare war, it took us a while to get over there and train troops. And Pershing is going around doing inspections, and he goes to the 1st Division where Marshall is, and they put on some exercises for him. And then Pershing gathers around the general in charge of the 1st Division, along with Marshall and a few other guys, and immediately just leans in to the general in charge and basically says, this was a disaster, and you guys aren't prepared, and you're a disgrace to the Army. And Marshall's listening to this and feels it was completely unjustified. And he says something. He says, General Pershing, I don't think that's fair. And Pershing grunted something and started to walk away in a huff. And Marshall, a young Marshall, this is in 1918, grabbed Pershing's arm and said, General Pershing, you have to listen to me. I've been here the longest and I have something to say. And for the next 5 to 10 minutes, he proceeded very eloquently to explain all the problems they were having, how they were solving them, and the actual success they were having in progressing to a point where they'll be ready for a battle. And Pershing muffled something and walked away. But he said to his aide, I want Marshall. Every time I speak to the 1st Division, I only want to speak to Marshall. So Marshall picked that up from him. He wanted people to be very candid with him, and people could be candid with Marshall. So that was one big lesson. And the others you mentioned, I mean, Marshall was really believed in and had to believe. Was his job, his and Stimson's job in the Second World War, to have the best and the brightest in the area of logistics, because he knew that when you're fighting a war in Asia and you're fighting a war in Europe and you're unprepared, the amount of work that's required to procure and store and distribute and all these weapons to these people, you needed top flight people to do that, because there were only 17 months from when Stimson and Marshall joined to when the war started. They didn't know it was going to be that long. And they knew they had a tremendous amount of work, and they did the very best people in logistics. And you had some of those people there. So he did learn lessons from World War I and a lot from General Pershing.
Right. The two of them definitely had an eye for talent. And Pershing sounds like he had an ability to cultivate that trait in Marshall and help him to see how to find the right people around him and promote them into the right positions. I'd like to talk about the buildup from the summer of 1940 to December 1941. Now, much has been discussed about how America was quote unquote unprepared for World War II. I've heard many numbers rattled off of after the Pearl Harbor attack that the West Coast had very little in the way of defensive capabilities, very little aircraft. Were there an actual Japanese attack on the West Coast, not much could have been done. But what's left out is that if we go back 17 months in the summer of 1940, America was even less prepared. So could you describe the state of affairs when Roosevelt appoints the two of them in the summer of 1940?
It was almost embarrassing to think about, but it wasn't that surprising. If you look back, we were always unprepared before all our wars. And that was one of the big obstacles. The Americans had a fear of a powerful army, going back to King George III quartering troops in Boston. So it wasn't a big surprise. But where we were, I think when Marshall became chief of staff, we were the 19th biggest army in the world. We had 170,000 soldiers in the army. Germany at that time had between 5 and 6 million, and that excluded airmen. And as you know, the Air Force was part of the army in the U.S. at that point and during World War II. Officers, there was a lot of dead wood built up between the war because seniority dominates promotion in the army, and you didn't always have the talented people rise. You had the people who just became more senior. If we were to build the army, we had no barracks. Newton Baker, the Secretary of War, and Peyton March, the Chief of Staff during World War I, did a very good job of putting up barracks to prepare for World War I, but they were all dilapidated, and they were not practically down to the ground. So weapons, we had the Springfield rifle, which predated World War I, planes. We had, according to Hap Arnold, who worked for Marshall as head of the Air Force, we had 300 battle-worthy airplanes. Germany had at that time, in 1940, 10 times that amount. Tanks, you might remember that Dwight Eisenhower became famous during the Louisiana maneuvers. He and Patton, the war games on somewhere in the American West. And during those war games, we had to use pickup trucks where they were painted tank on the side of it. I think the Nazis had about 3,000 in the summer of 1940 in comparison. We hardly had any. You could turn around to almost all the things from small to big, big items. And we were just short. And as you know, the Nazis had been building up for a long time. We just hadn't, because the isolationists put a big block on any of that. The isolationists thought that by being prepared, you were actually increasing your chances of getting into war. So they were against even preparing oneself for war, which is very silly, because you have to be prepared or you're going to be beaten. So it was very, very difficult. And when Marshall was named chief of staff in September of 1939, he had 9 months until Stimson joined him in July of 1940, and he hardly got anywhere. And Franklin Roosevelt couldn't help him much, because although he was someone who believed in preparing oneself and he was an interventionist himself, he would not have been reelected in 1940 if he were public with those attitudes. So that's the situation in the summer of 1940. We're completely unprepared.
How did they do it then? How over the next 17 months, they transformed an unprepared, poorly equipped army into a modern fighting force, despite the fact that isolationism was the predominant view among the foreign policy class in the U.S. government? How were they able to accomplish what they did accomplish?
Well, that's that really is the crux of the book, the partnership. They once they got together in the open door, they had tremendous staffs. I think you asked before about, you brought up the little black book. It started with the staff. Marshall was a very unique soldier in that during peace, when most soldiers kind of relax and they play a lot of sports and they drink a lot and they chase the wives of other officers, Marshall was always diligent and duty bound. And in one of the ways in that happened, he felt it was his duty to assume that at some point there might be a war and at some point he might be in a position of authority. And when that happens, he's going to need people. So he kept this little black book throughout his career where he would make notes on officers who he would come by, and the talented ones, he'd write their names in the book. And in 1919, for example, he met Eisenhower. And Marshall was helping Pershing put his memoirs together. And I guess Pershing had asked Eisenhower to do something as well. And the two men met. And Eisenhower and I had an idea about restructuring the memoirs. And Marshall decided it wasn't a good idea. But he was completely impressed, because Eisenhower didn't just say yes to someone who was more senior to them, but he actually debated it in a very articulate manner. And Marshall noted down the qualities of Eisenhower that he first met at that point. He had notations of Patton that were a bit different. He indicated that he would make a great tank commander, but that he was a little crazy and needed to be closely watched. So when it came to World War II, he had all these names down going way back, and he managed to put almost flawlessly the right people in the right spot. Now, Stimson needed a staff as well. He had a different recruiting style. If you look at his top five guys, every one of them went to Harvard Law School. One of them was number one in his class, Harvey Bundy. Another was number two, the Undersecretary of War, Robert Patterson. George Harrison, clerk for Oliver Wendell Holmes, presumably that many was in the top three or four of his class. You had this assemblage of John McCloy, one of the great negotiators of all time and great New York lawyer, Robert Lovett, who was one of the great bankers of his time and was the founder of Brown Brothers Harriman, along with Averell Harriman. Tremendously successful staff. I mean, yes, Stimson was an elitist, but it's not like he just ran an old boy network and pulled guys out of Harvard. They happened to have great careers as well. So with the staff in place, these guys went to work. And why did you need these lawyers with such a tremendous backgrounds? Because these guys were in charge of procurement, and they needed to sign contracts. They needed to negotiate contracts. They needed to sit there and look at what they did as if it was the most important law case they did, you know, teaming up together and doing what they could to basically rearm the country. And it was tremendous what they did. They, you know, in 2 years, they went from 170,000 to 5.4 million men. They put together barracks in 18 months, enough to house 1.2 million people in 250 locations, which is the equivalent of like building 250 towns of 5,000 people each. They had to build an air force from scratch. And this, people don't realize it. These guys were responsible for that, those things. So they had all the talents in place. They worked incredibly well together, and they did it despite the fact that they had these obstacles you alluded to. For example, I don't think Hitler really had too much of a problem if Volkswagen or Krupp or Messerschmitt got too much of a contract. But when Simpson and Marshall were putting things together and Alcoa came in with a bid that was for the highest quality product at the lowest price and the quickest deliverable, he got a hard time. They got a hard time from Roosevelt's men, New Deal guys, who said, well, no, that you can't give, we can't create a monopoly with Alcoa. So they had that tremendous obstacle as well. And they managed to get through it by hard work and excellent staff. And of course, help from Roosevelt, who, when he needed to and had to, would be aggressive in this, despite the fact that it politically hurt him.
Scott here. We're going to have a very short word from our sponsors. First, I want to give a shout out to all the great shows on the Parthenon Podcast Network, including History of the Papacy. You can find this and many other great shows at ParthenonPodcast.com. Listeners know that I always like to pull something out of a topic and apply it universally across history. But what I hear is that these two have an extraordinary ability to find talent and place it. And I don't want to be too glib and say, oh, this is a little factoid that can be bundled and given to business professionals everywhere, that the way that Sun Tzu is packaged up and middle managers like to apply his advice and think, well, this Iron Age Chinese strategist is talking about siege warfare. How can I apply it to my job as a middle manager for a marketing firm in Akron, Ohio, and beat out another company for this account at a ball bearings factory? So without being too glib on their lessons, what do you think it is about these two that make them so good at identifying and placing talent? Is it them being able to get over their own egos, being able to hear dissenting opinions, a somewhat nonpartisan approach to their jobs? What do you think it is?
It's a lot of things. Part of it you alluded to earlier in the conversation when you said he was, George Marshall was almost Washingtonian with this self-designed personality. When he was at Virginia Military Institute, he quickly realized that to command respect, you not only had to do well, but you needed to keep a distance between you and your colleagues. So he was very formal with people, to the point that I don't think a lot of people loved him, but they respected him tremendously. Stimson was very serious as well, a man who was absolutely humorless. I suppose when people were teasing him, he could laugh, but I looked at the archives. He served as a board of trustees for years at Phillips of Andover, and whoever was head of the trustees made a note about his style, and it matched everything I read about how he worked in the Army. Absolutely, you know, full concentration, doesn't like interruptions, had a hot temper when things got off track, no humor at all, and very goal-driven. So in answer to your question, why everyone could work well together, they were very inspirational and people absolutely revered him. You mentioned the Cuban Missile Crisis story and the what would Stimson do? You were alluding to something in the book where when Robert Lovett was brought in by McGeorge Bundy, who was the son of Harvey Bundy, who was on Stimson's chief of staff, at the beginning of the Cuban Missile Crisis, you're right, Lovett met down in Bundy's office and said, let's think about how Colonel Stimson would do this. So they were revered and respected. And I think when that happens, you're more able to recruit people than to work them as a team. They were also ahead of their time in terms of the concept of team building. Whenever Fort Marshall went to, he would always incorporate the building of morale into everything he did, everything he did. And Stimson as well would invite his staff throughout his career to his estate in Long Island, where they would, you know, have a work hard, play hard attitude, and they would ride horses and do fox hunts and play baseball and have intellectual games. And then when it came to work, he worked them to the bone. So it's almost of all the practices you read about, and I got my MBA in management, and these guys had them, and they were very successful at getting guys to work for them.
Describing Simpson's personality, I wish I could see him interacting with Churchill. If they were at some social event where Churchill is, you know, into his fifth or sixth brandy and smoking a cigar and spouting off witty quips and Stimson looking there stone-faced and blank with all the humor bouncing off him. I bet him and Stalin probably would have got along very well with similar, you know, stoic personalities. But something, speaking of his interaction with these leaders, after Pearl Harbor, the winds change completely. All the headwinds that Stimson and Marshall face are now at their backs because they have an establishment that supports a war effort and a military buildup now that they are in a state of war. The new challenge is that they have to deal with the different personalities and agendas of Churchill, Roosevelt, Stalin, their British and Soviet counterparts, a whole host of other leaders of institutions. What does that look like in the war period, and how are they able to strike this balance?
It's funny you bring that up, the Stimson meeting Churchill, because they were very, very different. And yes, Churchill would sit there and drink and, you know, start talking about letting the muskets flame and sending troops to crazy parts of the world. And both Marshall and Stimson couldn't stand it. They respected him because of what he did in the, you know, when England stood alone. But a theme throughout the book is, as you know, just from your knowledge of the war, but I didn't appreciate it until doing all the research, how vast the differences were between the British and the Americans over how to fight the Germans. You know, they agreed early on that the Allies should fight Germany first and Japan should be a defensive war until they could take Germany. But how to do that? The British absolutely did not believe that we needed to go into France and then Germany. They thought the war could be won without ever setting foot in France by bombardment and controlling the seas and blocking ports. And the fights that went on, Churchill and Allenbrook, who was Marshall's counterpart, they did their best to try to sound like they were in favor of it. But inevitably, when an agreement was made that they were going to set a date for D-Day a week or two later, like clockwork, either Churchill or Brooke would come back with a, well, you know, things have changed. So, you know, maybe we should do wherever first. And, you know, they ended up winning early on. It was North Africa. But right up until the very eve of D-Day, the British didn't want to go in. They were also afraid of the losses because of their experience during World War One. But Brooke's diary on the night of D-Day, he said that, you know, at the very best, it's going to be a disaster. And Churchill told his wife that by the time the morning comes, there'd be 20,000 dead Allied soldiers on the beaches. And of course, it wasn't even close to that. So that was a theme running through. There are some that think that if they think at all of Marshall and Stimson, that they were just logistics guys. But these guys, you know, they were also responsible for strategy. And Roosevelt was very much a commander in chief. And occasionally would have to put his foot down. And for example, he did when he came to North Africa because he wanted the troops to be engaged in the fall of 1942. But they had these arguments all along with the leaders of first the British, and then, of course, they had to deal with Stalin and De Gaulle later on. And they usually had a tag team approach. Either they went at it together or one and then one. And they had very strategic way of negotiating, working together as a team that was interesting. And all of this, by the way, none of us would know if it weren't for Stimson's fabulous diary. He kept one his entire public life. It's 4,000 pages just during World War II alone. And every night he's, you know, wrote down 4 or 5 pages of who he met, what they talked about, how he felt. And so you learn, it was a real pleasure to read that because you learned about all these discussions they had with world leaders and his innermost thoughts of them.
Now, of course, the two didn't get their way all the time. Marshall, for example, he wanted to cross the English Channel earlier than Roosevelt wanted. What were his goals and why did he think that was a more effective strategy than what eventually happened?
I think Marshall and Stimson were wrong in the case of, I think they were right, absolutely right, in that you needed to go into France. And that was proven at the end of the war. I mean, Hitler was not going to give up. And the fact is he didn't until the Allies on either side of him were knocking on his top of the bunker and he killed himself. But they were both, as John McCloy said of Stimson, he was a frontal man. He wanted to go straight over the parapets. And Marshall was the same way. They were just a little aggressive. And Churchill and Brooke were more cautious. And Roosevelt sided with him eventually because he didn't, I think Marshall and Stimson would have preferred not doing anything until D-Day. They wanted the first action to be the invasion of France. And Roosevelt eventually agreed with the British that, yeah, it's not the worst thing to get some experience in fighting in North Africa against troops that aren't as crack as the ones that are probably guarding the French coast. So they didn't get their way. It bothered them. And what really bothered Marshall was and Churchill admitted it after the war, all the British did. Churchill admitted that he strung them along, pretending that he was completely in favor of it because they wanted the U.S. to stay engaged in Europe. What they didn't want, which at one point the U.S. wanted to threat, was that, oh, forget it. If you guys don't do what we want to do, we're just going to switch it around and we're going to prioritize Japan and we're going to give you a little support in Europe. So it was tough negotiations.
There were other points of conflict. For example, Marshall wanted to replace casualties individually rather than by unit. And something that I think Simpson's been faulted with most of all in the war is the support for Japanese internment in the United States. So what were mistakes that they've been highlighted that have others have highlighted about them? And do you think this is a fair assessment or not?
Well, certainly on the internment of Japanese Americans, that was a big mistake. I devote a whole chapter of it in the book. And it's surprising that Stimson made the decision in certain ways because he was a man of high integrity. He was against it until he was for it. And it was amazing how quickly he turned. And part of the reason he turned was because John McCloy, who we hired, because of his expertise in espionage. McCloy worked like 10 years on the Black Tom case, which was a big explosion in the New York Harbor during World War I by German saboteurs or whatever the word is. So he let McCloy handle it. Roosevelt was pretty smart because he wanted Stimson to make the decision. And I think that's because Roosevelt was one of the great politicians of his day. And he knew there was something wrong with it. And so he made sure that Stimson made the choice for him. So it was a big mistake because really we could have protected the assets they were trying to protect, which were all the manufacturing facilities and military equipment from Seattle down to San Diego. And at one point, General Mark Clark, who worked for Stimson, reported back to Marshall this time. He said, yeah, no, I think it makes much more sense just to put a few people around the various military plants. But the pressure, you have to imagine the pressure after Pearl Harbor. And there was a while where Japan had a run on everywhere. There were victories everywhere. Stimson himself was worried the West Coast might be invaded. So every governor, every senator, every congressman on the West Coast was for doing something with the Japanese Americans. They had no proof of anything, but that didn't prevent them from making up certain things. Earl Warren, the governor of California, actually believed, like a few did, that the very fact that there was no proof was proof that there was proof. So a lot of pressure, they fell to it. And I certainly blame them for it myself. And I realized it was a mistake. But the real mistake, to me, the far greater crime, was the fact that they kept Japanese Americans locked up for 4 years, long after the threat from invasion on the West Coast disappeared after Midway in 1942. There was no threat after that, and they didn't release them until after Roosevelt was elected in 1944, and that was pretty shameful. Some people make the argument, a lot of people, and McCloy wrote a note to Robert Patterson in 1942 saying, hey, the real reason we put them in internment camps is because we feel there was going to be vigilantes who were going to go after them, the Japanese. There might be something to that. So that was Stimson's big mistake. Marshall? Yes, there was the replacement issue. It was a little wrong. He cut a little close with the amount of troops he was going to have. He always believed in listening to Roosevelt, and Roosevelt didn't want to have too many troops. So he had the famous 90 division gamble where he set the limit as to what the army would fight the rest of the war at 90 divisions. He cut it a little close, so I think he could be faulted for that. But outside of that, I'm telling you that the guys had very few mistakes during the war.
And that's realized immediately after the war is over or in the years to come. You begin the book with that quote from Winston Churchill, where he is shocked at how the United States was able to handle vast staffs capable of handling enormous masses and of moving them faster and farther than masses have ever been moved in war before. Could you describe essentially what the two accomplished in World War II? Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
Gosh, everything. You know, one of the reasons I wrote the book was because I feel like more than many, I have an appreciation of how difficult the accomplishment that you just described that Winston Churchill said of the two men. I am a banker, and I've been a banker all my life. And my particular niche in banking is I finance the large commodity traders of the world, people that move vast amounts of commodities from areas where there's an excess of them to areas where there's shortages. In financing and monitoring the risk of these companies over the years and listening to them during countless meetings, their problems always were around logistics. Would they have to figure out where to store something at origin and then transport it and then store it the area where they're transporting it to and then distribute it. And it's this massive logistical exercise in trucks and ships and trains and facilities. And when I was doing research and reading up on both of them, I felt like I really appreciated how massive it was. I don't think I'm being too hyperbolic when I truly think it was there. It was the greatest management feat in the history of the world, because they're not just overseeing a modern war like World War II, not just in Europe, but in Asia as well. And the Asian theater was massive. I mean, it was just massive. At one point I measured it and it was like a circle east to west, north to south of like 4,500 miles. So the logistics were huge. How they did it was, you know, I started to talk about it, but they worked tirelessly. They brought together, and this is a major theme of the book. I think it was a perfect pairing that Roosevelt got when he brought together this, I described this army lifer with this Wall Street lawyer. And when they combined their talents, it wasn't, yes, they did split up with Stimson managing the civilian issues and Marshall tending towards managing the military issues. But almost every question there was during the war, you could tell they got together and blended their talents together. And I think that was critical in how they achieved success, not just them, but their staff as well. I mean, Hap Arnold worked with Robert Lovett, who was Stimson's man in charge of air. And Hap Arnold, of course, was the head of the Air Force. They worked just as well together as Stimson and Marshall. And same with McCloy and some of the Marshall's counterparts that he had to deal with. So it was this tremendous blending of civilian and military talents that allowed us to succeed in the way that Winston Churchill was very impressed about. And by the way, Winston Churchill called Marshall privately the greatest figure that emerged from the war. And Dwight Eisenhower, when he was asked late in his life, who the greatest American he ever met, his answer was George Marshall first with Henry Stimson a close second. I mean, you think about the great men Eisenhower met in his life, and those were the top two great Americans he's met in his life. So these guys had a reputation among those who were in the game at the time as very high, but history has somehow forgotten them for the reasons I probably mentioned before, because it's just more exciting to read about Patton's exploits or Omar Bradley or, you know, Rommel, Montgomery, etc. And if you ever watch the History Channel, they're always showing things on these guys, and they're showing tons of things on Hitler and Stalin, and there's never been one on Marshall and Stimson. So it's quite interesting.
I'm curious, just to dig into that theme a little more, which is the scope of your book, why did their partnership work so well? Is it simply because they both had qualities that complemented each other? Was it something else? And I'm reminded of other partnerships that were equally fruitful in history. Abraham Lincoln and Ulysses S. Grant, or Captain Cook. And I forget the name of his first officer, but their relationship was very similar to the Russell Crowe movie Master and Commander, where you have the captain who's of slightly lower social order, but very competent, effective leader. And his first officer is an educated man who's a natural philosopher. And the expedition combines both effective crew management, but scientific discovery, which benefits society. And there's a similar interplay with Captain Cook and his first officer. With Stimson and Marshall, what is it about their partnership that was so effective?
It's a few things, Scott. You know, they first met each other during World War One. I think it starts with respect, and they just had a great chemistry during World War One. Stimson, who was a soldier at the age of 50, by the way, which was remarkable, and he wasn't just a glorified soldier who was behind front lines. He felt so duty bound. He did use his connections to get commissioned, but he felt that was fine because he wanted to serve in the artillery where he was in harm's way. And when he was over in France, he went for some training, and one of his instructors was George Marshall, and he thought he was fantastic. So he invited him every day during the 9 days that Marshall was there for a horseback ride every day, and they ate lunch every day together. And they got to really respect each other at that point. So respect was partly it, but they were very similar in that when you look at the law and New York law, Stimson was considered, and public service, he was considered a man of the highest integrity and also bipartisan, probably the most bipartisan high figure of the 20th century. He was a Republican, but he would leave the Republicans on any issue that he didn't believe in. Early on in his career, when Cleveland was against high tariffs or the other way around, I can't remember, he voted for the Democrats. And of course, when isolationism hit, Stimson had nothing to do with the Republicans. And that's why Franklin Roosevelt, a very liberal Democrat, could bring this Wall Street Republican into his cabinet. Marshall, similarly, was known, if for nothing else, integrity. At the end of the war, all the four members of the British Joint Chiefs of Staff, and they had tremendous arguments with Marshall, all said he was 100% honest throughout the war. So I think this high level of integrity was recognized in each other, their high respect for one another. They were both absolutely driven by duty. So this all appealed to one another, but they also had this special ability to realize that what they were doing was so important. They could have complete candor with one another. And as anyone knows, it's not the easiest thing, whether you're talking about friends or subordinates or superiors at work. They would have some heart-to-heart discussions, and they both believed it was necessary to have for them to work successfully together. So I try to capture it, but it's this tremendous respect they had for one another that allowed them to do so well, and their shared view that duty was the first and most important thing. That probably is the crux of it.
Well, we would be remiss if we didn't talk about the Marshall Plan, because as we know at the top of the episode, talking about these two, if the name of any of them rings with people, it's Marshall in connection to it. But really, that's one reason why World War II is celebrated in American and Western history, not just because of the victory, but because not only was the war won, the peace was won. Not the case with World War I, where we can appreciate the stories and learn about Alvin York or the Meuse-Argonne offensive, but in a sense, the peace wasn't won. And part of the reason it was won in World War II is the Marshall Plan. So could you talk about it and your take on it and why it was so successful?
First of all, I'm going to start a campaign to rename it the Marshall-Stimson Plan, and I'll have to tell you why. As we were approaching the end of the war, a lot of the talk in Washington was about what to do about Germany, post-war Germany. And leading the effort was the Secretary of Treasury, Henry Morgenthau. And he basically, and he got a lot of people to join him, wanted to turn Germany after World War II into basically a farm, strip them of all industry, and have the people there just live on subsistence levels. He also wanted to try and execute, I can't remember, but a large amount of the Nazi high command. And he actually at one point got Churchill and Roosevelt to sign up for this. Stimson had nothing to do with it. And he was incredibly emotional about it in his diary and publicly. And he would stand there and just lecture Roosevelt about why that was the dumbest thing to do for so many reasons. He said, one, this is not our nation. We just don't execute people without a proper trial, etc. So he was really responsible for the Nuremberg trials. But two, he said, look, the Nazi government is terrible, but the German people, he said, are exceptional. They will be, have been, and will be the economic engine of Europe in the future. We need them to be strong because we need a strong Europe And we need friends to balance where we know the Cold War is going to head. He knew that the Soviet Union is going to be an enemy going forward. So he pushed really hard on that question, harder than just about anything other than the how to end the war in Japan and, you know, the use of the atomic bomb, etc. And he wrote a lot of memos towards that, and he turned both Roosevelt and Churchill. And so flash forward a few years when Marshall is Secretary of State under Truman, and he actually sent for the memos from the archives that Stimson wrote in the last year and a half of the war on the issue of post-war Germany. And in my opinion, he very much supported and led the way for the Marshall Plan, because he was inspired by Stimson's mention of how Germany should be treated after the war and built up. So I like to think it should be the Stimson-Marshall Plan instead. But I think certainly the lessons after World War I had to play a big part in both Marshall and Stimson's view of what post-war should be. It absolutely didn't work. So I think anyone with intelligence after World War II would say, well, we can't just simply have another Treaty of Versailles. So they learned their lessons well.
Well, that's a good point, in that perhaps some of the prouder moments in American history in the 20th century have to do with the post-World War II order, that revenge was not meted out on civilian populations. I mean, of course, there are isolated incidents, let's say in the Pacific, by individual soldiers, but as a matter of policy, that wasn't the case on the Japanese home islands, leading to decades and decades and decades of peace and cooperation, same in Western Germany, as opposed to, say, the Red Army going back across Eastern Europe in revenge against Nazi Germany. Well, there's a lot to talk about here with the legacy of these two. So what do you see as the legacy of these two, and what lesson do you hope that readers take away from your book?
Well, I think that the legacy has to be, aside from their achievements, that, and I think it's very topical today, I think the concept of bipartisanship is a huge lesson here. Marshall never voted in his life because he felt that it was an army officer should be apolitical. And Stimson, as I mentioned before, was just so issue-oriented. He was a Republican because he tended to believe in more of those issues, but he turned against them, as I mentioned so many times below. So the legacy is that, and it is also, I think, a huge legacy. And I think one of the reasons that America has achieved such greatness during the 20th century and before that was the concept of civilians, of the military being subordinate to civilians. And this is something that Marshall and Stimson stressed throughout their working relationship. If you ever see a photograph of Stimson and Marshall together, you see Marshall a few steps behind. And if I have time for an anecdote, I'd like to tell you about Stimson's last day in the office when Marshall really sent a message about the civilian-military relationship in the U.S. to all his generals. Marshall's last day was his 78th birthday, and he had a very busy day planned. He was going to address the cabinet at Truman's request about his idea, Stimson's idea, that is, of sharing the atomic secrets with the Soviet Union. As you can imagine, not a very popular thing, popular idea, to share a secret of something that costs us such a huge amount of money to build. So he was trying to prepare that during the day. And then he went to the cabinet meeting, but it was delayed for and went on. And Marshall, in the meantime, gathered 125 generals at the tarmac where Stimson's plane was awaiting to take him back to Long Island in retirement. He got an army band there. He also organized all of Stimson's staff to be there. And it was a hot day, and I verified this through a weather app that allows you to see historical weather. And Stimson was about an hour plus late. And Marshall made these 125 generals, and it was the largest gathering of army generals in the history of the country, line up in two lines on the hot tarmac in the hot sun for over an hour, waiting for Stimson. And when Stimson finally arrived, cabinet meeting over, he walked the line, the army band playing, greeting all the generals. And when he gets to the end of the line at the stairs of his plane, Marshall was there. And Marshall took off his hat, slightly bowed his head, shook his hand, and escorted him up the platform. And it showed a couple of things. I mean, there was a love and respect between the two men together. But I really think Marshall was trying to send a message to his generals. And the message was, look, the U.S. Army will never have a better reputation than it does today. We just won the war. But he was trying to send a message that we report to the civilians. And in honoring this man today, the civilian head of the Army for the last 5 years, he wanted to send a message of the proper balance between the civilian and military. And I think that's a huge legacy that continues today, that, you know, we are a country where the civilians do control the military, and you can't say that around the world. So I think that's another big legacy of the two men.
That's a great illustration right there, and says a lot about their particular views on civic service. Well, there's a lot more that we couldn't get to in this discussion. And for listeners who want to check out Ted's book, the name is The Partnership: George Marshall, Henry Stimson, and the Extraordinary Collaboration That Won World War II. Ted, thank you for joining us.
Scott, thank you very much. Big fan of your show. Appreciate it.
All right. That is it for today. If you would like to see show notes for this episode, along with all my others, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. That's the name of the podcast network that I'm a part of, along with James Early's Key Battles of American History, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, and other great history shows as well. If you'd like to support History Unplugged, the two easiest ways to do so are to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. The second way is to join our membership program, and if you do so, you'll get completely ad-free episodes of the entire back catalog, which is 600 episodes and growing. Just go to patreon.com/unplug. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.